Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. This is me, Andre, and I'm here with Vansh today. And it's been a while. So last time that we did an episode was post-US Open. And a few things have happened since. Like we had like two 1,000 level tournaments, like one on the women, one on the men, a couple of 500s as well, lots of 250s. Yeah, lots of things happening in the tours right now, some changes. The finals are approaching. Then actually, we also have the WTA Elite Trophy, which is coming for the first time since 2019, and players are qualified for it already. I'm not sure if the race is already finished for this one. Unfortunately, I couldn't really find any information on that on the WTA site, at least not very easily. So if there's something that they want me to find, it's hard. So if it's there, make it easier for me to find, please. But yeah, like WTA finals are coming up, ATP finals are coming up, and yeah, and I think that was actually another 1,000 tournaments on the WTA side and one on the men's side, and then yeah, season's gonna go long as usual. But yeah, how are you doing, Vansh?
Yeah, basically to summarize everything you said, there's just a lot of tennis since the US Open. Basically, all is just jam packed within,
and there's a lot more still.
A lot more still to come, yes. Yeah. You know, you got at least 3,500 still on the ATP. Then you got a whole week of 250s after Paris, which is the week after Basel and Vienna. And then you got, you know, the year-end finals. And then, obviously, then you have, like, the Davis Cup. We call that the extra stuff, you know, the Davis Cup afterwards. And then the, you know, not to say, obviously, winning for your country and all that is really big. But in terms of ranking points and stake in terms of, like, you know, rankings, race, or individual team tennis, individual competition as opposed to team tennis is done by the 19th. And then you still have, you know, the next gen finals. So good promo for people 21 and under and a good way to see new faces if you're catching them for the first time. But basically it doesn't stop until December 2nd on the main tour release. We've got challenges all over the place as well. So basically, yeah, the sport just keeps on going and going and going. And with that, I guess there's quite a lot of content every single week. Then that comes out now. But yeah, I mean, right now the Asian swing, like we're almost through with it. I mean, we finished Beijing and we right away moved to Shanghai for the men because tournaments before or after the Davis Cup, like the women kept going, you know, after the US Open, they had San Diego 500 and then a week of Guadalajara. But for the men, we wanted to accommodate the 12-day Shanghai Masters for the first time, which is a men's only, you know, competition. So that's the first time we've actually had a 12-day event ever that's men's only, because we've had the combined ones obviously with Madrid and Rome earlier this year, so we kind of got a flavor for what that's like. But when it's just men, you know, it definitely goes on a lot longer, and it feels even longer than 12 days because by the time you get to the latter rounds, you're splitting it by top half, bottom half, and so you end up having some days where some people get more than one day of rest, and if you lose early, there's not really a whole lot of tournaments you can go and play unless you're entered in a challenger beforehand and you're qualified based on your ranking. So there's some of those things that come out of the tournament. You know, they can make some more money with it being over two weekends. There's all of that. We don't need to go into massive detail about that, but basically we finished Shanghai and then now this week we've got, you know, Tokyo and then a couple 250s. And then for the women, they also have, I believe, three 250s as well. So like six events coming up. But then the week after is where, you know, we start getting down to the nitty-gritty, which is Basel, Vienna for the men, and then WTA Elite Trophy, which, to be honest, yeah, it's always very forgetful. I'm not surprised that, you know, I mean, the qualification stuff is a little confusing. Like, it's basically 9 through 19 and then one wild card. And I think I assumed before this week that Wildcard was probably going to be Shenwen because it's held in China. Shenwen is a big deal, a big star, as we'll get to later on in the show. But now she's in the top 20, and I think she's pretty much qualified now.
Yeah.
The only issue, Andre, with the year-end thing for me, the WTA Elite for me, is that some people are going to go in the year-end finals in Cancun and try to be an alternate. So like Sakari, I don't know how interested she'll be in playing the WTA Elite trophy because that's in China, and then she'd rather travel to Cancun, you know,
and just wait
because Vlhova hasn't been playing since the US Open. I don't know what her health status, injury status is. It's very likely that Sakari gets in as an alternate just based on that alone, or at least gets to play one or two matches and then has a shot at getting out of the groups.
Yeah.
With her winning Guadalajara because she just climbed up a lot. And then all the other girls as well, like Kvitova, I think, has already shut down her season. She's in that 9th or 19th range. Krejcikova is playing the doubles in the year-end finals. So do you prioritize that, which, you know, Krejcikova has an amazing resume. She probably wants to win that again.
Yeah.
Versus going and playing for basically, you know, a second-tier WTA final. So I don't know, and in a completely different continent. So when you're already in China, okay.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
But there's a lot of things that could shake up with that event. I personally would love that the WTA is in a great financial state at some point. Right now it's not. They're operating on a loss and, you know, everything is because of the tour moving back to China and all the Peng Shuai stuff combined with, yeah, COVID and just, you know, the organization growing, you know, not as big as the ATP in general. They're going through a lot of financial crisis, quite frankly. So I wish they had enough money to market, you know, the year-end finals early, to market, you know, even the elite trophy stuff early, you know, get their website more in order, I guess, and just, you know, make it more, because the product and the players are really great. The what they have to offer is amazing, but there is some confusion for fans right now because of the calendar mix up and, you know, all of that. So I don't know where I was going with that, actually.
Yeah.
I think I was going to say that.
I think you're basically saying that the WTA
I was going to say that instead of that, I wish that they had a next gen.
Oh, yeah.
Like they do for the men, because I think that'd be an awesome way to promote 21 and under players on, because they have so many of them on the WTA, from the Fuvertovas to the Noskovas to the, you know, even like the Parks and the, you know, I'm not coming up with names very well off the top of my head right now, but there's so many 21 and under that are, you know, really ready to make a splash. So that'd be a good way to do it, because we've seen it work on the men's side with all the winners with the next gen finals, like actually going on and having like pretty awesome careers so far.
Yeah, I think the one of the good good ways to maybe get this elite trophy to work, excuse me. The other thing is I actually kind of like it because you get to see more of like top 20 action. They're good players as well, especially the WTA right now is like extremely.
Oh, the top 20 is so deep right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. It's very, very deep. Like they're all extremely talented. And a lot of them actually have been even like top 10. So like you'd be basically be seeing like the bunch of like former top 10 players just like playing a tournament. Like some of them, you would actually kind of like them to make the WTA finals. But maybe to mitigate that, like it could be interesting, like maybe instead of like doing 9 through like 19, I think maybe just go like, I don't know, like 11 and until like 2022 or something like that. So then you have like two alternates to the WTA finals. We're probably going to prioritize that anyways. And it kind of, in my opinion, it gives a lot of players still like some motivation to kind of try to crack the top 20 by the end of this season. Not that you have that much of you don't need that much of an excuse to try and get your ranking up. Is always good enough to be there, just like on the lookout for the Australian Open, for example, that you want to be a seeded player. It helps a lot in that regard. But at the same time, I feel like it kind of makes in a player's mind, like competitiveness, like it's if they want to be competitive. Now that you mentioned, I think you mentioned as well the Davis Cup as well. If they want to play things like that, like they play the Indian Cup and the Davis Cup, I'm assuming that's something that actually goes for points and prize money. Like that is something that would make them even more motivated to play. So I think the WTA Elite Trophy, I think it's a good idea. Maybe it's on poor execution grounds as well. But like, it's, listen, a lot of things are so rough right now for WTA anyway. So like, I guess like if they can at least like get those things going, like this tournament will be played.
I hope it'll be successful and that most of those players will end up playing. We'll see how it shakes out because it hasn't happened in 3 years. And I wonder how motivated these players, like especially like because like I just don't know the status of a lot of them. Like even Bencic, for example, like hasn't been playing forever. She's also in that group, you know. And then like Kvitova was already shut down her season. He's like, I don't know if she'll want to go as an alternate or not. So they'll have some decisions to make, let's say. But you do get quite a lot of points. I think the winner of that gets more than you would for a 500. And some of these 500s, like if you win a 500 nowadays on the WTA, I consider that a pretty big deal. Like I would take you very seriously because winning in terms of like winning big titles and winning majors even, because 500s are like, you know, all top 30 players basically now.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, starting next year, basically we're going to be only allowed to play two 250s and then one of them has to be in your home country.
Yeah. And and the other thing is like, and the other thing is that, well, since we've mentioned that, like, the WTA's depth is so huge that, like, if we even winning a 500, it's almost like winning a 1,000 at this point. So, like, because the players that are playing there are normally so big.
Between winning a 1,000 and a major anymore, if they keep doing the 12-day format. The only difference is majors, 128-player draw. This one, 96. I mean, obviously, you have the prestige and the ranking points and all of that more at majors, but in terms of, like, your day-to-day routine, in terms of, like, your preparation and everything, like, you still got to win mostly. If you're unseeded, you got to win 7 matches to win a 1,000 now over 12 days.
Yeah.
Whereas then if you're seeded, like, if you're a Svantec, you still have to win 6.
Yeah.
So it's, it's quite tough to win these. And that's why we're still seeing, like, new champions every time. But I feel like it's good because it's a group of, like, 8, 9 really good players. Like, this WTA field for Cancun, love it.
On him.
Like, all these players are deserving of, like if I were to tell you, read you this top 8, this would be a thorough, like, these were the 8 players this year, like, no ifs, ands, or buts. I don't know who I would trade for any of them. I don't think I would trade any because they're all just, they've achieved so much. Like, 7 or 8 of them have been in a major final. Mm. The rest of all won at least one big title, all of them. Even Pagula has won a big title. And
2 of them, really. Just...
2 of them, yeah. I mean, this year, like...
One this season, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the field, like, I'm really excited about Cancun, I will just say, because I think the way the groups are going to shake up, like, it's going to be great no matter what.
Yeah.
Can't really go wrong with it.
Yeah. And we obviously, like, a player that is going to be missing out in Cancun, at least for now, it's, we mentioned her before, Sakari, just, she won her second title of her career, first since, like, 2019, I think.
Yes, and, 2019 Rabat. Yeah. So it's been 4.5 years.
And it was a jump as well because it was a 250 that she won. And that now she just won her first big title of her career in Guadalajara.
Yeah, it was a long time coming because she'd been in, obviously, everyone knows about her semifinal and final woes.
Yeah.
But so consistent, always getting herself in those spots.
Yeah.
Especially tournaments outside of the majors, like Vegan and Vega on tour. And like she knows that, she knows all the chatter about it. She even mentioned it after she won that, you know, basically this is, you know, I've heard all this stuff and she knows what's being written and all that said about her, kind of like the Coco Gauff approach, I guess, after
exactly.
the US Open. But aside from that, like I was very happy for her because, you know, she had to go through Garcia in the semis, which could have been tricky, but it ended up being pretty straightforward. And then she was up against a finalist that was very unexpected in Caroline Dolahide. You know, outside of the top 100 and just had a really good week. The field wasn't as strong, you can say that, sure, but she was still a heavy, heavy favorite. And the issue has never really been about, like, because I know that she can turn up and beat a top 10 player on any given day. She has a pretty good record against top 10 players. But it's sometimes these matches where, like, she's lost a final before to Maya Sharif a year ago. So, even though, you know, it's also the stage and the occasion more than the opponent, I think. So the fact that she was able to get over that and win without dropping a set in any of these matches, she still came through, you know, Garcia, who was playing some really good tennis, and she still came through Dolahide in the final. And just overall, like, it was just such a big weight off her shoulders to get that 1,000. It doesn't necessarily mean she'll go on. And, you know, it was a little bit kind of like Rublev winning Monte Carlo. Like, it was kind of a long time coming.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
In the sense, like, you know, if things break through again, she'll probably get there again and probably win another title. And you know, keep putting herself in the mix, keep staying in the top 10.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
for her that she can go all the way and win one, I think is pretty big, because she's also like not the youngest player anymore. She's 28.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, like, you know, you maybe have 3 or 4 really good years still left, but it's kind of hard to know. And so for her, yeah, I was just really happy because she was so emotional. And
it's as you were mentioning before about the Elite Trophy, like maybe she will decide to go to the WTA finals. And I think it would be even deserving if she and managed to get in, even if it was like by, as you were saying, like if a player decided that they were going to withdraw, you wouldn't feel out of place that Sakkari is there. She wouldn't feel like, so often it feels in the ATP, for example, you'd get like an RBA going into the ATP finals as like an alternate. Sometimes you can feel like, oh, it's just kind of like feeling on the spot, because you kind of know that it doesn't necessarily have much of a chance. Like you will be a bother, of course, but you'd say like Sakkari has made, I think, the semifinals,
other than the finals. Made the semis last year, and she didn't even drop a set. No, she didn't even drop a match. She won all of her round robin matches.
Yeah. And yeah, so like obviously you would still make the field extremely interesting for the WTA finals. Oh, and you would still not necessarily know what the semifinals and finals would line up.
I think she will probably go as an alternate, just because like the chances of her playing one match are still pretty high, given that we haven't seen Muhova play since the US Open, and Wondrusova was also nursing a bit of an injury at the US Open against Keys or in that tournament, and Jabeur is also nursing a bit of a knee issue. So all things point to Maria going, I think.
Yeah.
Can.
Yeah. And if we're, yeah. Chance. Yeah. But if we're like getting back to like more, I guess like more recent events, like we obviously had like Iga Świątek winning her first 1000 tournament of the season, which for me is insane. Given what she's won this year as well, like that's, I guess, like alluding a bit to what you were saying about like the 500s being extremely important. She has won two of them, one of them being Stuttgart, which is which could be a 1000 event. It's basically treated as a 1000 event.
Świątek has set the bar so high, like in terms of what to achieve, because the year that she had last year, like to come even close to expecting her to do that again. It was just like generational stuff. Like the year that she had last year, like to win 37 matches in a row like that, two majors, like, you know, being 21 years old, like turning 21.
She won the first 4 1000s of the year as well, right?
Yeah, it was just ridiculous on both clay and hard courts, and then winning the US Open, you know, coming through those gritty matches and like basically just establishing herself already as an all-time great in the game, and then coming back this year and even just defending a major. Like I said, this year was going to be a success if she won a major. She did that. She won a major. She defended her title. And I think like she's obviously, what happened is like basically the rest of the tour got better, I think.
Yeah.
Basically like the rest of the tour, everyone, Sabalenka, Rybakina, Pagula and everything, everyone got better. She's still winning over 80% of her matches. Her record this year is 63-11, which for a normal player is like, you know, just already like, they'll never get there. And for her to do that again in her sophomore year, and then this was already her fifth title of the year.
Yeah, exactly.
She's now won one at every level this year. And, you know, she still has a year in finals to go, and she basically dominated the 1000s. Like, if you look at her career in 1000s, like, she hasn't played Guadalajara or Wuhan, but everything else, her worst, best result is like semis. Semis in Canada, semis in Toronto this year. So, like, that's her worst, best result right now. And it's like, she's only 22. So it's kind of insane, like everything that she's achieving and the way that she looked that week in Beijing, particularly the last three matches against Garcia and then Goff, who beat her in Cincinnati and was on a 16 match win streak herself. It was kind of like back to their previous 7 matches of like, oh, I can just hit you off the court and kind of play like essentially my brand of tennis and it's going to work and I still have the matchup advantage. Now, Goff was a little hurt in the second set and it was a good effort for her just to get to the semis as well. So she's, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be a one-sided head-to-head completely, but it'll just be interesting to see how that plays out, because I think they'll have some interesting matches. And, you know, I think I would expect Goff to at least win a couple more. And
yeah, for sure.
It'll be a rivalry for sure, because she's really stepped up her game too. And so it's just like the women's tennis is in great hands. Like Sabalenka is deservingly number one with the year that she's had. Świątek now has a chance to get it back. So I'm interested in that, because the field for Cancun is really good, but there's also the year number one online. And she's, I think, 700 points behind. It would be really huge for her to get 2 year number ones in a row.
Yeah.
And especially after all the talk about her this year, like the field catching up and some of those losses like Rybakina and the Australian Open and Ostapenko at the US Open, some of those bigger hitters, you know, that can still challenge her. But it was very interesting because Samsonova has a very good head-to-head against Rybakina. She's won like she's 4-0. And Rybakina has a very good head-to-head against Swiatek. I was trying to figure out, like, why does this triangle exist? You know, why is it that Samsonova has a really good head-to-head over Rybakina? That one is the hardest one to explain. Samsonova over Rybakina is the hardest one to... Rybakina over Swiatek makes a little makes a lot of sense to me, just because, you know, huge first-strike tennis, and just, like, rush Iga right off to the first shot and not really letting it into any kind of rhythm. And, you know, just it makes sense based on the matches I've seen. But then for Swiatek to come out and just roll over Samsonova in the final, I was like, okay, like I can, because but what I liked about Iga this week or in Beijing is in, when she was getting outhead, she wasn't trying to outhead the opposition herself and just fight fire with fire.
Yeah.
She's relying on her strengths, which is she has generational movement. She can cover the court amazingly well. She has incredible speed. She has a great return and an awesome open stance backhand. And beforehand, they can do damage when she's ahead in the rally. But if you're trying to outhead your opponent when you're already being outhead, it's not going to work out very well. And she adjusted. She made some really good counters this week. Like her serve, she was hitting it a lot better. She was hitting body serves a lot better. She was adding some new things, coming to the net a little bit more often, adding a bit more variety in her game too, which used to exist before she won Roland Garros in 2020. But then afterwards, when she started becoming this dominant machine and amazing, like just couldn't lose a match, that's when like she started to get very, very methodical in terms of how she plays. And it was just set every single time. And then a few times this year, we didn't see her adjust when she played against really big hitters. And she kind of went about with the same thing. But this week she adjusted. She actually showed me something very different, like that she can win these matches against very different type of players and well in a row, because she was, that match against Garcia was one of the best matches of the year in the quarters.
Yeah.
And she was down a set and like 3 times 2 points away from the match. And every single time she just came up with the goods and delivered. So yeah, it was just a very good week. And I think what she needed, because first 1,000 since Rome 2022. And it just didn't really feel right. Like in all of our minds.
No,
she hasn't won a 1,000 yet. And so then, I mean, now she has, and she can even finish the year number one. And if she doesn't, not a big deal. It's still a very good year. So
yeah. And to be fair, like just the fact that she even has a chance of like claiming the number one back, and if she finishes it, just like goes to show like not only it was obviously a successful year, but like to come out after what happened last year to get as many points, even to still be in that position, you know, like she had to still play well, and she kept the number one for a while still. I think she lost it only after the US Open.
Because she had such a huge lead at the end of last year, it was going to take something really, really, really special for anyone else to get it back. And
yeah,
Sabalenka like, kind of did that. So
yeah, it was great though. Like Sabalenka had a great season. She still had like a few things that she needed to work on. But I'm glad that she was able to come out some of the semifinals as well, that she was not necessarily winning, especially at the Grand Slams. She did lose two. Wait, did she make the final? Yeah, she did make the final.
Yeah, those losses were tough. The Mohova match where she was up 5-2 in the third, and then the match against Jabeur in the semis, she was also leading. But then I think it was important to win the semi in New York.
Yeah.
I know, win one again, and then she was back in the final, and then, you know, then she keeps Kelvin with an excellent version of Goff after the first set, who just played the perfect way to beat her, which is use her speed and her defense and extract a lot of errors, which you guys covered really well actually on this podcast, you and Owen, with the final. But
I think that I do hope that Sabalenka is able to, you know, play a super good tournament like a WTA finals, because it's like one of those sad things that happens, like that, especially I'd say more often at the WTA side, like when a player goes on to become world number one without necessarily winning the title that they're in. It happens with Pliskova. I guess we had like Dinara Safina wasn't winning Grand Slams and things like that. So it's a little bit more common, I guess, because of the dominance of the big three. We haven't really seen to become number one, and the ATP has just become tough because of this this blockage of the big three. It kind of happened a bit with Medvedev last year, it's just good to see that the number one player is playing well. So I would say, like, if Sabalenka is able to do that,
yeah.
It's going to be a great thing, I guess, for the narratives online, to shut down some of the haters as well, but also for her to just, if she is able to finish the year as number one,
points to go with that number one that I don't think people should be, like, it's different for Yankovic, you know, like Safina, even Wozniacki and stuff, because she's won the major.
Yeah, she won the major before.
And all the other three, she won a 1,000, which was Madrid. She won a 500 before the Australian Open.
Yeah.
She's had some other good weeks and finals, Indian Wells final too, and this one. And you're in finals, even last year she made the final. So she'll have to defend that, but that's not, you know, she more than made up for it with the year that she already had, I guess.
Yeah.
There's like, I don't know, Garcia, Muguruza, players like that, or a bit more really hard to read on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah.
That's when, like, people are like, oh, I think Neuron Finals is cursed. I don't know if, you know, if... And then you don't see that consistency later on, but I think with this group...
Yeah.
Like, they're all just playing so well, and they've just sustained it for such a long time that I think, like, it should carry over to next year.
Yeah, it should.
To a large extent.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the people... Especially because, like, most of Rybakina, Świątek, and... Goff and Coco, like, they're all 25 and under. So unless they get injured, and unless, you know, some other players, like, that are not on our radar right now and step up, like, I think they'll be sharing a lot of the dominance. Like, it's not going to be one person dominating, but it'll be, you know, this group of 8 to 10. So.
Yeah, hopefully Rybakina is able to stay healthy as well, like, for the part of
the season. She's so powerful getting, you know, viruses and just getting...
Yeah.
Cold, and there was that whole thing with that performance bias, but she was able to put that behind her and actually have a pretty good week, beat Sabalenka, and then just then lost to Samsonova, but still she got to the semis, and so
very good. And if we get to this week's tournaments, like the ones that finished this week as well, we had three WTA tournaments, and obviously the Shanghai one that we've mentioned. I guess we can, like, try to say something about the Shanghai tournament right now, since we've been just doing WTA for now. So we had the Shanghai tournament was the 12-day format, as you said. Like, what did you find of this?
Well, I mean, the storyline at the end was interesting in the sense that, like, all these players had done something before at 1,000 levels, so I knew that, like, for one of them, they're going to win their second. And so that was already cool, because Dimitrov finally got the win that he was looking for in terms of his year, because, like, his year has been very consistent.
Yeah.
But he kept running up against, like, he lost to Zverev 4 times, or he lost to Djokovic twice, he lost to Alcaraz twice very comfortably before this, Medvedev, Stefanos. Like, he's ran into, like, a lot of top 10 players, but, like, winning 2/3 of his matches every single time, winning, like, 2 matches in every event, and, like, he just looked... Like, this was his best season since 2017, but he really didn't have that much to show for it in the rankings. But now he actually did, because he played, like, peak tennis against Alcaraz after losing the first set. And so that was, like, back to, like, very, very good version of peak Grigor. And then he was able to back it up and beat Jarry. And then Rublev was also playing, like, some of his best ball-striking tennis in a long, long time.
Yeah.
And he impressively beat Humbert and Paul and some of these players that he actually doesn't do very well against, but he managed to play really, really good this week.
Yeah.
And then he got there, and then Arkot, just known to be super great in hardcore Masters 1000s, which hasn't quite translated to the majors yet, but he's always there. He's always somewhere present in the latter rounds of these events, and with his serve and the quick conditions and just the game that he has with the backhand that stays so low, how well he defends, how good he is at coming to the net as well. The main issue in his game usually is the forehand. But on a quicker court like this, where he's getting a lot of help from a serve, and he's not having to play a whole lot of long rallies where the forehand could become suspect in some spots, I actually thought he was going after it a lot more and using it as an approach shot, coming to the net a bit more with it, you know, using the forehand to set up his backhand and just win a lot of points on defense. So he was playing really, really well in the tiebreaks, which he's played so many of this year. That's kind of been the thing with Arkadiusz. Almost every match feels like the same, because he's been playing so many tie breaks, but you just know his serve is so good that he's going to get to the breakers, and he's not going to lose serve very often. And that already, with how good his ground game is, it puts a lot of pressure on guys. And so it was the story of the final was also about a serve, because it was could have gone either way with him and Rublev, but every single time he stepped up with a serve, like 21 aces and a bunch of unreturnables and like really big spots. And Rublev will have a couple of regrets, but at the end, I think the final was decent. I mean, maybe not everyone's cup of tea because of the styles of both, but
yeah.
Still like a pretty good finish. I mean, Sinner, I was hoping to see him like back it up a little bit more, but he still won a couple of matches. And then Ben Shelton like finally won back-to-back matches outside of the majors, and he played that really good match against Sinner. Korda obviously had an amazing week. It was a good rebound week for some of the guys whose rankings don't quite reflect, I guess, let's say, the peak level of their game. I think that's a good way to put it, because like Korda had a very good January, but then he got injured for 3 months and couldn't play with his wrist. And then he showed some flashes in Queens, but he never really got going. He struggled with consistency. He wasn't physically all the way there. And then finally he's put together three really good weeks, and he beat Medvedev, which for the second time this year, which is proving to be a very good matchup actually for him in terms of tactics. Each time he's played Daniil so far, and then eventually he lost to Hurkacz. But yeah, now Hurkacz has won two Masters 1000s, and he's now the next step for him is just, how do I translate this into the hardcore Masters?
Yeah.
He obviously has the Wimbledon semi, and he's now number 11 in the race, so he could also sneak into turn maybe.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Kind of strange. It doesn't really change my overall perception of any of these players.
Yeah, I do find that like, I do think that Rublev, he was showing to me like being a bit more patient, like as in like from what I saw, like from most of the highlights, it looked like
he was backhand very well.
Yes, but I saw that. Like I thought his backhand was his rally backhand like felt like he was able to like add more spins, like put it a little bit deeper, and he was actually like hitting it down the line a lot better, timing it better as well. Before, it used to be a good shot, but like nothing necessarily that special.
That he can't deal with. And now he can actually hit you with it, and he can rip it, he can take it early down the line. The down the line thing you mentioned is very big, because he likes to stay in the ad court.
Yeah.
And he likes to dictate with his forehand, kind of inside out, inside in, and just create points that way, which is safe, high aggressive tennis. But then the backhand, sometimes like he gets a little bit short of the tray eight. He's not quite, you know, doing enough damage. But now that he has that makes him, that adds a different type of dimension to his baseline game that makes him tougher.
In the forehand, I thought he hit his forehand a lot better as well, like just in the sense that like for me, and I used to draw the comparison with David Ferrer a lot more, because David Ferrer was the type of guy who would hit this forehand always deep, always in the corners. But I felt like Rublev was doing a lot of that as well, which in a sense was kind of easier to read. If you're like a Medvedev is staying like far away, like in the court, like it makes it easier to defend. But I felt like this time he was like using the angles a lot more. Like he was trying to like go for like more the service line where he meets the outside lines. So I felt like he was just changing it up a bit in terms of his targets. I think is as good as his game can get, I think he's getting there. Like I feel like it's the type of like small improvements that are necessary like to stay where he is. And he hasn't had like the best of the seasons either. So in comparison to like his own standards, I guess. Like he did win Monte Carlo, but I don't think he was necessarily
He's kind of in terms of seasons, he's always been kind of the same player the last 4 years in the sense. Always at that 5-8 range. He always been in the Grand Slam quarterfinals. Usually having one deep or one or two deep runs at a Masters event, picking up some other titles along the way. I think this year he won one other 250 in Bastad after Wimbledon, and then he won Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
But he made three major quarterfinals. So I guess you have that, and then this other Masters final, which he came so close to winning, he had championship point, and Hurkacz just wiped it away with an ace. But I agree with you on the forehand. I like the fact that he's using the width better.
Yeah.
And the angles, because then he can just hit the straight one down the line. And if he could just volley a little bit better and just be more comfortable at net, it would just make his life a lot easier, because now all of a sudden he can finish points without having to rely on the
forehands.
Without having to rely on hitting that same forehand like five times. He can hit it twice, just come in, finish easier. He tends to do better in doubles, actually. because he's so tough for the guy who's at the net that he can just, you know, hit very good passes.
Yeah.
He can come up with some good shots, like kind of from the baseline. But then the second serve, I do think he's protected that a little bit better. The backhand, the improved tactics on the backhand helps him protect the second serve a little bit better, I think. Although it still can be attacked because it's predictable and you kind of know when it sits up, you can rush him like off that first shot. But I like his, I like the way that he fights and plays. Sometimes it's a little hard to watch because he's so hard on himself.
Yeah.
And like on championship point today, after losing a really tough match, he was obviously emotional, and he's a great guy like afterwards, and he's so lovable like in the locker room, and everyone gets along so well with him. He's funny as well, very relatable. Just overall, like such a great content machine for the ATP. in most of their videos that they do, like he just always is. If you know Rublev as Zenin, you know it's going to be an awesome video because he just delivers.
Yeah.
With his wholesomeness and his content and his style of speaking English. But during the matches, he's so hard at himself, and he'll hit himself in the leg and there's the shin with the racket. And it's like you want him to vent out the steam, but not by hurting himself. So that's the thing that sometimes can be tough to watch, but he's...
Yeah. Yeah, in a way, I would rather...
I'm better a little bit mentally as well. Like, you know, even the Monte Carlo thing that he won, I think that was big, just like it was for Sakkari, like just to win one of those big titles. And
yeah,
he knows he can do it. So,
yeah, I think in terms of like him hitting himself, I think I would prefer he hits the ground and just breaks.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, seen before my racket smash, yeah. Because at this point, it's like
it doesn't change anything. The only thing that like you're smashing your racket anyways, but this way you're hurting yourself. Like you literally could injure yourself so badly that you could.
Exactly. Yeah. And sometimes like I was there in San Diego once when he was playing Nori a couple of years ago, and he hit himself so hard on the knee. He had to, you know, there was blood coming out, and he had to like take a bit of a so-called timeout and just, you know, get that. It's just like that's just self-harm, and it's just psychological damage. And
yeah.
I prefer he just smashes racket. I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, just take the violation, but...
Yeah, you get a warning, and you don't have to pay a little bit of a fine, but if it helps you play better, why not? Because he's clearly not somebody who can just bottle it in, because that doesn't seem to work. Like, he does usually do a good job of resetting. So, yeah, just hit the ground, smash your racket next time.
Yeah.
Not that I'm advocating him to do that.
Yeah, no, but like if you're going to hit a racket somewhere, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But, if you can't help it.
It's good also because like also he's definitely going to qualify now for the year-end finals, and he's number 5, and he's separated himself a lot from 6 through 10. Or 11.
I think there's only one spot left, right, for the finals.
Well, I mean, like Rublev hasn't locked it in yet, but I assume he will. I think Tsitsipas will probably do. I think Zverev will too. So I think they'll... these really one spot. Well, like I mean it's interesting.
Yeah, it's true.
Obviously the first four are in, and then the next out is like Rublev 5, Tsitsipas 6, Zverev 7, Holger Rune 8. Although Rune is struggling with a back problem, and he's not been himself since Wimbledon, and he's struggling to win any matches. It might be wise for him to just shut it down for the year if he's not in a great place physically, but and then like Arkač is now 11th. Arkač could get in, Rude could get in, Fritz could get in, but I think pretty much Rublev, Tsitsipas, and Zverev, they feel like locks to me. So I feel like there'll be like a spot, there'll be like a 6-7 player battle for that 8th spot. That's what I think.
Yeah, same. And I mean, obviously, like in terms of ATP finals, it doesn't really matter because Alcaraz is already qualified. But what do you think? I think since the US Open hasn't really been as good. Obviously, I think that's his first tournament since. But
almost since Wimbledon, though, to be honest.
Because... True. Yeah. I mean, he did have the big Cincinnati tournament, which he actually struggled to get there. But
yeah, that was quite an ordeal because I was there for like all those matches. And he, since Wimbledon, he was... You know, I mean, it's still like an amazing year, just like Miga, like you win a slam and you're one of his all-time greats. Like, it's a great season whether or not he gets to number one or not. And to be fair, if he doesn't get to number one, it's like Djokovic won 3 slams, got to the finals of the other one.
Yeah.
It's a lot of ground. You have to like basically win almost every other tournament or get to the finals at least to like, even have a chance with the schedule that Djokovic, even with the small schedule that Djokovic pulls. But like, he never really found the range on his forehand, and he was still getting along to further in all these matches. And like for any other player, it's like a great result, but we judge him on this all-time great standard. So it's like 16-5 seems feels atrocious, as opposed to like, you know, winning. It's like, you know, for him, it is a surprise that he didn't win any of Canada, Cincy, US Open, Beijing or Shanghai. So like five events that he entered.
Yeah.
And, you know, three of them without Djokovic, and he didn't come away with the title. But I think he's just, he's putting a lot of pressure on himself right now to get that number one. He is obviously not 100% physically in terms of his explosiveness. Yeah. You can definitely see that in terms of also like his, yeah, just like the way he's defending sometimes in the corners and just how, you know, it still takes a really high level, like top 10 level kind of tends to beat him right now, but he's just, you know, he's not converting a lot of his break chances.
Yeah.
It's basically just very normal after you win a slam. It's kind of like what he went through after Madrid last year, in between Madrid and the US Open.
Yeah.
It's like kind of like that. And I think he's just exhausted because it's been a long year, and he's, what will help him is that, like, I just hope he's 100% healthy for Australia.
Same.
Because to me, that matters more than finishing the year number one. Because you can get the year number one later. He'll get it back again at some point.
Yeah, he's only 20. He's not like,
he's already had it for 36 weeks, which, by the way, is like amazing. Like 36 weeks already.
Yeah.
It already puts him like almost within touching distance of Murray, who had to do it in the big three era when they were in their prime. But for him, like, like he won a slam. I don't really care that much about what happens in Basel, Paris, and
year-end
finals for him. I just hope he doesn't injure himself seriously so that he doesn't have, so that now he's compromised in the offseason like he was last year.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And then he couldn't play Australia. I think that's bigger because like the tournament, like I don't want to say needs him, but it would be so much better if he was there because of the possibilities and the matchups and the star power he has and, you know.
Yeah. I would rather even like he maybe like misses Basel because I don't think that there's much need for him to play there unless he actually wants to get like some indoor court practice. Yeah. But still,
right now he just wants to give number one a go because if he does win Basel, he'll be tied with Djokovic. So then it's basically who does better in Paris and turn between him and Novak. Yeah. But like I don't know how much it really means long term. Like he can do it and like because right now that's all he has. He can just put all his eggs in that one basket for the next 4 weeks. And then he's not even playing any warm-ups pre-Australia. I read that he's not going to be playing United Cup or any of the tournaments. So that will extend his offseason a little bit to where he has almost 2 months, which is like 2 months is a long time for a player like Alcaraz. Like he could come back and we could see some more improvements because already we saw quite a bit more improvements this year in the first 6 months. He already seemed like a better player to me from February to Wimbledon than he did it last year. So, it's already a better year than last year, but it's just, like it's kind of all about the majors, which sounds crazy to say about a 20-year-old, but it's just that because he's done so much, it's kind of mostly about the slams at this point. Like the fact that he didn't get to play one of the four.
Yeah. I think Australia and maybe Roland Garros, like in a sense, because Australia, he hasn't really played it since he got to the top 10. Like he obviously had like the good run where he lost to Matteo Berrettini, but then like came back like next year, didn't play. And he was like number 32, I think, or 30.
Yeah, it was not in the top 30. So we haven't seen Alcaraz like
Yeah, everyone I've seen Alcaraz at the Australian Open. Yeah.
So that will be like a first.
Yeah, maybe just to set the tone for what you're to expect, like in the next few years of his career, maybe next 3 years or five. I think he definitely should be aiming to be healthy for the Australian Open as best as he can. Not that he should think too much about it right now. I think like if he wants to end his season like on a high note, I think he would like to get like Paris and Turin or one or the other. And number one would obviously be really good for him. I think it wouldn't be great. I think confidence-wise, they could probably make him feel like he is still at the same level as Djokovic. Not that I feel like confidence is much to be worried about Alcaraz, but he did sound a little like down like after his US Open semi against Medvedev. But yeah, like
be very honest after these losses, like he'll straight up tell you that you know I need to be more mature.
Yeah.
And that I lost my focus and that I need to be better prepared. And but he would say these things that feel like
this feels like the end of the world at times.
Yeah, and it'll be like very honest and raw.
Mm-hmm.
And he won't be like, you know, just giving you the usual answers when it comes to.
Yeah. But yeah, but at the same time I feel like even if he does focus on that, I feel like it's an entire must for him to not lose sight of the long term and or the medium term really being Australian Open exactly. And the Slams next year because, yeah.
I guess it will help that he has some days off before Basel actually starts for him.
Yeah.
I basically read he's not going to be training or practicing for 8 days, which is like, you know, a good amount of time. So maybe he'll be fresher.
Yeah.
And then in Basel, like, I think most of the top 10 players are in Vienna. But obviously there's a lot of other thing players that can, you know, keep it close and just have to work really hard and win those five matches.
Yeah. And speaking of...
wants to give it a go and just see how close it
is. Yeah, for sure. And speaking of Basel, like remembering who did he lose to in that last year in Basel? Nowhere to be seen nowadays, unfortunately.
Yeah, nowhere found since Indian Wells, basically.
Yeah. He has been had an injuries here and there, but at the same time,
the knee, right? The knee issue.
Yeah, the knee got rough.
In Paris, he had cramps, diarrhea, or something.
Yeah, yeah. He was like a virus. I think a diarrhea.
I think he's just looking for a total reset now. Like come next year, like I think he might drop out of the top 40 or 50.
This
has no form whatsoever. Like last year, he was winning 16 matches in a row, 3 titles in a row, and.
Yeah.
Beating Alcaraz and Basel.
And now I don't even know when was the last time he won a match. Maybe it was Toronto.
I think he won one round at the in Cincy. He beat Berrettini there.
Toronto he lost the first round. He lost in the
first round. To Mannarino last first round in Australia. I mean not Australia, US Open. Yeah, he's had a really rough time. Like it's just not gone according to plan at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even see much wrong.
He won a Labor Cup match, but that doesn't really count much.
Yeah, he does tend to do well like in group competitions. Like I feel like he kind of needs like, I feel like he needs some sort of like motivation, like just energy to go off of. But like it's been tough for him lately. I don't even see much wrong with this game, to be fair. Like I feel like it's just like the execution, maybe the mind is completely off.
One of those games where like, you have to be really on.
Yeah.
And play your best because when things are not working, he doesn't have that many other options right now.
Like, even the backhand, I feel like the backhand is actually slightly better than what it used to be. But
he wants to be just relying on his serve and his forehand and his athleticism. And if he can just get back to the basics and just focus on those strengths.
Yeah.
You know. Because what happens is he tends to become really like mechanical when things are not like going well, and it's kind of doesn't have like he doesn't have great variation on the second serve, so it's kind of predictable middle of the box. The backhand is so like
used to be much better for whatever reason. It just changed something about his motion. Feels like
his arms are a little too stiff sometimes.
Yeah,
too close to his body more.
Yeah,
he shanks it a little bit.
I feel like, the backhand for me is just like, it lacks the drive in it. It's like has too much spin because like probably, as you say, like he I feel like I felt the same thing. He just keeps it too close to his body. So like, I feel like he needs to like improve on that one. And because of that, he's been running even like the same problem as like at Tsitsipas, or like how Dimitrov ran into Rublev, which is like just like campy on the ad side and like leaving so much space like over there that like on his forehand side, like a player just kind of like can rip a back and down the line when he has time, or even just like run around it and just leave this open. Yeah. But yeah, like I feel like needs to, as you said, like he needs to have a full reset. Like he needs something to go on.
We'll see if he makes any changes also to his coaching team.
Yeah.
Because maybe the whole Tony Nadal thing is not quite an ideal situation for him, given that he's not 100% always going to be there for Felix at all costs. Like if he's playing Rafa, or if he's, and because he's still part of the academy, and the whole thing is maybe not, maybe he could be better with a different setup. I don't know. Yeah. But probably has a lot of thinking and work to do in the off season.
For sure. Yeah.
It's all right because he can still come back and still have a really good start. He just needs like a fresh green slate, basically, and then start back totally the end of the world. Although he's very good indoors. So this part of the season is usually very lucrative for him. And same with February. So,
because he actually started the year somewhat well. He lost two tournaments in a row to Medvedev, which is kind of understandable, the form that he was on.
It was okay until Indian Wells. I remember in Indian Wells, he'd won that epic match against Paul, and he played Alcaraz as well. It was a good match.
Yeah.
And then ever since then he had the knee thing in Miami. That kind of, since then, he's
just been a little bit of a sleeper slope for him. But yeah, maybe in Basel, he's going to be able to just like find himself like a bit of form. Like he's going to have the points to defend. And maybe he's got more
in Basel. He's playing Vienna.
That's true. Right? Yeah. Weird. But I guess this is the same week. It doesn't really matter in terms of like defense of the points.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe I would have come back to Basel if I were him.
Actually, I don't even think he's playing Vienna. He's playing Tokyo this week.
That's true. I think it's true. Eh?
Yeah, he's playing Tokyo this week.
It probably makes sense in terms of...
I don't actually think he's even on the entry list for Barlow.
Yeah. It might make some sense for him because he's already in Asia and he's not really...
Yeah.
He doesn't really have to adjust much to the time. He's not playing Turing anyway, so...
Yeah. So I think he'll play Tokyo this week. We'll see how that goes. But, he's playing Tokyo. And I mean, that's like the main event, but that's where like Fritz and Rude and Rona and everyone will try to qualify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gonna be tough, but yeah, we'll see.
Same with Tsitsipas. Like, I feel like a lot of these players are just searching for form.
Tsitsipas has been in a rough time as well.
Yeah. Yes, hasn't gone well for him since the start of the U.S. swing, really. And also there's coaching stuff happening and relationship. Combine that with the tennis. He's still coming up unstuck against lefties and big servers, and could play Stricker already in the first round of Antwerp this week.
What do you think?
I mean, honestly, it's just like, just try to qualify for the year-end finals and then just see what else is left of this year. But he has some improvements to make, for sure.
Yeah. And I think he's been hitting like most of the shots kind of well. I feel like it just, his mind is just
also the interesting thing with his coaching staff has been so irregular. Like sometimes he has full posters and then he doesn't, and then And then after the U.S. Open, he said he's only going to have him for the U.S. swing. Didn't really go great at the U.S. Open, and then now he's back with dad.
Yeah.
And the dad dynamic with him and his son, there's always a part of him that's attached to his dad and his and that coaching philosophy. But as long as he sticks with it now and doesn't keep trying to change or do these things, we'll see if things happen.
Yeah, who knows? He only basically had dad before, like when he did like most of his big runs. So
There was just a lot more scrutiny on the relationship when there wasn't coaching allowed. Now that it is, it just feels like,
This is ready to go.
Yeah, he might have used like that other voice who is more qualified as a coach than his dad in terms of the technical improvements and changes he has to make. But the issue is just sometimes he goes so overboard with the coaching and he's constantly yelling at him in Greek and things, and Tsitsipas looks kind of uncomfortable and he's not always very receptive to it, and you can see that kind of stresses out his game a bit more, and it happened last year, the year in finals, it happened this year against Medvedev at Rome, and these things just keep flaring up. But I feel a little bad for him because it's not always just you know, people can say on Twitter that, oh, you know, you should just get rid of his dad, you should just fire him, but it's really not that simple. You have that father son, they think there's a lot going on we don't know. So it's tough, but like, I mean, the Chuka Process thing wasn't quite jumping in his mind the way he would have hoped.
And you talked about lefties, and we already talked so much about Tsitsipas here, but a new guy that's coming up, you mentioned lefties as well, Ben Shelton did better this week. I feel like the biggest, and I've read also on Twitter, not to say this is my full, personally, I'm not taking 100% credit for this analysis, but he's been playing with more of a plan. He feels like he has more intention in his shots. Whereas a lot of the U.S. Open just felt like energy, and just like he's just like, you know, just going all in because of the New York crowd, and just hitting 140, 150, whatever, how fast he can hit his serves, but just because he just kind of felt like it. He can still hit those, but I definitely felt like the way he was hitting his backhand, I felt like it was a lot full of topspin, just kind of like just trying to like make something happen. And just making it a rally shot. I thought it was great. Played a great match against Florida.
If you add those elements to better backhand, better rally tolerance, more patience, more point construction, all of a sudden you have a top 10 player, no doubt, because the serve is one of the best in the game. It's so hard to read. He could actually still get even better with the serve. It could be more precise. More. He could make more first serves. He could be, he's also not afraid to roll the dice on the second. He has his volley game can get even better. It's already pretty handsy. He has good feel and touch. The forehand is very good, very big. And then just the energy that he brings every single point, and the passion that he plays with, which it just seems like he can just keep doing that for hours and hours. And he's, this is the first time he's won back-to-back matches outside of the Australian Open and the US Open on the main tour level. This week, and he managed to beat Sinner coming back from a set down, and he just got so many unreturned serves. He won the unreturned serves battle by a big margin against Sinner, and that seemed to help him because Sinner is such a good returner, but he couldn't return a lot of those first serve deliveries back on a consistent basis, and then he just packaged it so well with the rest of the improvements. And I think he's a good guy in general because he brings something different and fresh to tennis.
Yeah.
And it's like a fresh young face, 20, 21. So far, none of his behavior to me has really crossed the line in any way. He just is very celebratory. He comes from a college background. He's just very enthusiastic, kind of like, you know, some people can say it's over the top celebrations, but I don't think it's intended to be like that way. It's more just to pump himself up, and it's kind of the way he knows how to play, right, from as a junior.
Yeah.
And I guess he's kind of transcending the sport with a celebration of the...
already signature.
So you already see people in other sports like copying it. And it existed before Ben Shelton did it, but it was just meant as a joke for his folks on the track team that he had back in school in Florida. And it was just a fun little, you know, thing sometimes that can become viral.
Yeah.
And now he basically does it up for every...
Yeah, so it was good for me to checking in like some as well. Again, I couldn't really catch any match for real this week because everything was overnight. But like the highlights and extended highlights I saw, like this Shelton quarter match was really good. Bit nervy at times. Like,
would you say Tennis TV has done a really good job this week with the highlights?
Yeah.
And in general, like overall, they're just doing great work when it comes to content. And then they're showing like points in different angles.
Yeah.
I saw that, but there's some angles I like more than the other. I think I just like the traditional angle the best.
Sometimes it can be good to watch the angle just to see like how far
I like,
you know, just get like a different context out of it.
I like how they include all of them so you can like choose the one you like, and it's just like good exposure to the game. And then like the quarter Shelton match was pretty wild too.
I love how like it showed like a different in personality for both of them. But also Korda's returns were ridiculous.
It was like he was up 6-1 in that third set tiebreak, and then he wasted a lot of those points and let it go back to 6-6, and he got so tight.
Yeah.
And then he finally pulled it out 8-6. some good composure at the end. And then Shelton told him at the net that, you know, that backhand inside in winner you hit was ridiculous. I hit like a 145. Yeah. And he still returned it with a winner. But Cordo is also one of these players that's just so smooth to watch. Like just the stroke production and how tight he stays to the baseline. And he's kind of like a hybrid of like, he's like a hybrid of like Federer and like Burdich. Because he has like the ball striking of Burdich, and then he has like the short stroke production and like the way he steps into the court and like how he can half roll these certain shots and I guess the smoothness and easiness with which he plays the game.
I feel like his backhand reminds me a lot of Agassi as well, like in just like how kind of like short, like just like the short take back and just like a very smooth compact stroke, especially off of the backhand.
And it's like such easy power, and it's
exactly
like, it's very fluid, and he can sometimes spray on his forehand. He can obviously still get physically a bit stronger than Ian right now. The serve can get more better. But the fact that he's 21 in the race and he skipped like 3 months of the year, three pretty big months. I think it's like, if he can just stay healthy longer next year.
Yeah. Could be a break.
Because he's made second week of French Open before too, man. Same with Wimbledon. So he can definitely play on all surfaces.
Yeah.
He's beaten Alcaraz before on clay. He's beaten Medvedev now twice on hard court. I mean, at some points in the second set, he was just toying with Medvedev with his returns and how well he's, using the game plan against Medvedev, mixing it up and that serving volleying. So, he's like, I think American men's tennis with Shelton and Korda in the mix gives us some more chances to maybe get to a slam final one day. I don't know about winning one, but slam final would be the big step.
Just checking in, like, just who's in the race for the next gen finals. It's pretty all right, to be fair. Like, obviously, you had Alcaraz and Rune and Shelton and Musetti would be like the most interesting players, but we all know that Rune is not playing, Alcaraz is not playing, Shelton is a question mark, but could be interesting. What is it?
Go on or do it. Musetti, there was an incentive because he used to be in Italy.
Yeah, now it is.
I don't know if he'll chase it this year, but we'll see. There's some other good, exciting players in that. I'm excited to see Stricker, for instance.
Arthur Fils is in it.
And Fils, Fils is the big one. To me, Arthur Fils seems like, the kind of guy that next year we could be talking about him in the top 20.
Yeah, maybe.
And maybe he's the one that wins the whole thing in the end.
Yeah.
Maybe that's my early prediction. Without seeing the draws and without seeing any, I think Fils is going to win the tournament.
Yeah. Well, he has one professional title, so.
Sorry? That'd be a bold pick next
year. Yeah. To be fair, if Shelton plays, I'd pick Shelton, I guess. But what? A final note. We don't have to go too deep into those, but like we obviously had like three tournaments this week as well. We had like the I don't remember the name of the city, but Pagula was a soul,
which I think was big for her, like on a personal and emotional level, because of her mom being from South Korea and from Seoul and. A story about how she was adopted.
She was left at a police station. Adopted.
It was pretty wild. I mean, that story. And then, 4 years later, winning the title. I think she pretty much beat everyone. She was playing there. She was just a heavy favorite in every single match. There was one set that she dropped along the way against Claire Liu.
Yeah.
But then she came back right back to work and won the next two sets, 6-3, 6-0. And then the final was close for about four games, and then Pagula went on a stretch where she won like nine games in a row and then kind of separated herself. And then second set actually got tighter a bit again, but managed to close it out. It was some good tennis.
I definitely felt like if this was a bigger tournament, more better players were playing, Pagula's level was not her best. I feel like she locked in like for a lot of the points, and she showed like a lot of what she's good at, but she made a few errors here and there that like were most likely due to like being nervous and just like actually more towards like the end of sets and then towards the end of the match in the final. I did feel like it was important for her. And I at first when I looked at where she was playing, I realized, wait, why is Pagula playing Seoul and this 250? Because I didn't really see the name of the tournament. I saw why is she playing there and like not the 500 this right now? And I checked out, oh, it's in Korea. So it makes a lot of sense for her to be there.
She's one of those players that just loves to play matches.
Yeah.
And just win, because she wins so many, she plays so many, and it's like...
Isn't she at almost 150 doubles. Right now, this year?
Yeah, I think this year it's like 128 now if you combine mixed doubles and singles, and she goes deep in all of them, and it's like... At some point, I wonder if that actually hurts her in singles in the majors.
Yeah, maybe.
Because she takes all three super seriously. So, like, even on her days off, she's playing those matches, and I wonder if, like, emotionally, she has what it takes to, like, really raise her level, like she would in a 1,000 or a 500, where maybe she's not playing that week in doubles or singles, but she's also one of those players that just doesn't like to practice as much and prefers to play matches and get the reps in that way. So, she's always giving herself 10 chances to win one major every single time, because she has three tries and she's just so good in all three. She hasn't actually won one yet. She's been to a final and won doubles, finals and mixed this year. But that is something I have to start factoring when I look at Pegula and slams, because I've picked her now deep to go reach semis and finals, because I felt like the quarterfinal thing wasn't actually a real mental block. Like, some people were making it out. I thought she was going to get over that hurdle. But then now that I think about the mixed and the doubles, and it just makes me think, like, okay, maybe she might get to a point where she hits a wall in some of these tournaments, fourth round quarters. She comes up against someone who's playing really well on the day, like a Madison Keys, and then, you know, maybe just doesn't have that extra step, but regardless.
Yeah. And it's easier to play well in doubles in a way, because, like, you have your partner, there's, like, less movement in a sense. Obviously, the Grand Slams are, like, a full set, and, like, the games work just like the singles, but at the same time, it's still, like, there is less movement that goes in. So, like, physically, you can stay fresher. And, like, there's obviously less matches as well. So
it can be a good way to warm up on the off days. And it can be, as long as it's not, like, occupying a lot of space in your mind.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But, you know, but it's just not something that the rest of the top 10 have, let's say.
Yeah,
like, she's rare in that regard. I guess Krejcikova, when she gets to the top 10, is similar boat. But, like, yeah, like, for her, it's probably just good for Cancun, just to get some of those matches, because match wins are match wins regardless. So.
Exactly. And we also had Qin Wen winning. Man, I'm going to get the name of the city. Hold on. Like, I knew it, but then I forgot.
War.
She played in Jinzhou. Yeah, that's what I... Yeah. Jinzhou, and she won it, and she did, like, a little karaoke session at the trophy ceremony.
That was so cool. I wish other tournaments do that now.
That's funny.
She sang beautifully, by the way, but that was just... I didn't understand what she was saying because it was in Chinese, but it sounded musical and it sounded in tune, so... But the main thing is, like, her tennis is very in tune right now, because, like, to beat Krejcikova from a set down in a 500 finals is no easy task. And I guess it was very even match until about 4-all in the third set. And then, because, like, they traded all these breaks, and Krejcikova had a couple of chances to go up 3-1 in the second, and Jing Wen saved it with two really big serves, got out of that game, and then broke twice. Krejcikova broke twice, and then 4-all, 15-40 plays a great game to break, and Krejcikova makes a couple of loose errors, and then she served out of love and 6-4 in the third. So well done to her. And she also beat Sakari along the way. She beat some other pretty decent players, and it wasn't the most stacked 500 if we compare to the other 11 of this year, but it was still very
high level, I feel like.
Yeah, at level, especially with the opponents that she had to beat and win. And then it continues our great form from the Asian games as well, which she ended up winning. She's starting to do really well in Asia, which is not easy because she also has a lot of pressure, and she's quite hyped, and rightfully so, because she's a big star in terms of her personality in interviews, and also in where she comes across after matches, and just the game that she has. It's a very big game. Like, she plays aggressive front foot tennis, really, like, you know, dominates on the first two, three shots of the rally, like, pretty complete off of both wings. The serve can still get even better. It's already getting more improved. And then she doesn't have a coach right now because there was that
whole... I was about to say. I think it's interesting, especially, like, after the whole...
Maybe that's giving her some more drive and motivation, because she was not...
Yeah, exactly. I was happy to see that, like, she did well in spite of the situation, and instead of, like, going on a spiral and, like, playing badly. Yeah. I think not to obviously throw shade at like Fissette and his her former coach, who like pretty much ditched her to go with Naomi Osaka. I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, like, we don't know our terms of the contracts.
It's obvious.
But it didn't look like a friendly, yeah.
And in her mind, I think she felt like she was cheated because she didn't think that, you know, she wanted more of a, the communication was a bit off, it seemed like.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Because, like, if I was her, if I was the coach, like, I kind of understand it from her perspective, his perspective, too, that, like, if you're, like, looking for a stable, like, way to make money, maybe you'll go back to someone who you had a good rapport with for 2 years who was offering you like a probably a much better deal just in terms of like the star power and the whole this thing. And then I also get it from Shin Wen's side where it's like, you know, I achieved all these things. We were ready for a breakthrough and then now you're leaving without telling me. So it's, I get both sides. I don't really, no one really knows like what happened.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
But in her mind, for her to use that as a little motivation and fuel and not get herself down for 5 months and not have great results.
Yeah, and then coming back, that's her biggest title, right?
Yes, for sure. It's her biggest title.
And at home, so that's it's all the good ingredients for like a...
It is, you know, and she won Palermo after Wimbledon as well. I was looking this up, she was 17 and 13 on the way to Wimbledon, and I was kind of waiting, like I was waiting and waiting. I was like, when is Zhang Qinwen going to win something big? When is she going to make that splash, you know?
Yeah.
Are we slightly overhyping her? Like, I was starting to have these questions in my mind because... I just wasn't sure if our game had caught up yet to the level that people were talking about.
Yeah.
She lost early in the majors, and but then after Wimbledon, she really put it together. Like, she won a clean 250 in Palermo, then she reached the quarters of the US Open, and her losses were not bad losses. They were to, like, Sabalenka, Świątek, Rybakina. And then, like, so she's, like, she was 17 and 13 before Wimbledon. Now she's 17 and 5 after Wimbledon. So,
huge
general win percentage game. Two titles and also the Asian Games, which I didn't even count, but
that's just good for confidence for sure. Yeah,
maybe she'll win the WTA Elite. Who knows?
Yeah,
because it's also held in China, and she seems to really embrace that pressure. And
I read that she is the recipient of the wild card. So it was on
and
Twitter.
Now she's already in based on her ranking. She's good enough.
Exactly. Yeah, so she would be there probably. I think she would play. There's nothing, and again, like, I guess it goes like by with like, she has obviously no chance of like making the WTA finals, but so why not do the Elite Trophy? I think it would be really good motivation for the lower 20s, like the lower top 20s, I think, to make it. But we'll see.
Good week for Krejcikova too to get to the final, and sometimes you lose matches like this. She ended up winning the 500 in San Diego against Kenin.
Yeah.
And it was the same kind of situation for all facing break points. There she was able to get out of that jam and hold and put the pressure on Kenin and break to win the match here. It wasn't quite able to work out for her, but I thought it was played at a pretty high level, the third set. The first couple of sets were very one way in terms of 6-2, 2-6, or 2-6, 6-2. So it already came down to the third, and still a pretty decent beat. She's 11. She's, I think, 11th in the whole race. She kind of been missing for a big part of the year after Dubai. She lost those three tournaments in a row to Sabalenka, and then after that, she said that she was ready to be one of the big four. Which didn't end up working well in her favor, and she lost a little bit of confidence. She got injured also in Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Hurt her a little bit. But then after US Open, she's rebounded nicely, and kind of weird, because I did expect her to be in the top 10 by the end of the year. She's kind of back to where she was, but in a different sort of way, where she's won a couple big titles, 100 level plus. And she's obviously very capable of doing it again. So she'll probably continue this way. I think she'll be in the mix.
And just one last note, finally, as well, like, I'm Canadian, and I'm happy that Leila Fernandez won another title, the third of her career. Her season was like up and down, like wasn't the best. Like, she is now, she was number 60 last time I checked, but she probably would have jumped up a bit.
I don't know, she's in the rankings. I think she's 37 in the race.
Yeah. Okay. So she might be doing better now, because she almost dropped out of the top 100, I believe, this year.
Let's see. 43 in the rankings. Okay. So 60 to 40 is a good jump. And this was one of the stronger 250s. Like, to go through Azarenka, beat.
So who retired, by the way. Yeah, Zarenka had to retire.
And then also the match against Mira Andreeva was big, coming back.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Against one of your rivals in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
That was like kind of a statement win, like I'm still the alpha kind of thing.
Yeah.
Against one of the best 16-year-olds I've seen in a while.
And I think, really good. I think her for this problem has been, her game has just not been at the level that she's wanted it to be. I think her mentality has been really good.
Kind of been,
she's fought a lot. Yeah,
I'm really impressed with how she persevered this whole year.
Exactly.
She took a lot of tough losses, like kind of on the chin. Yeah. She dealt with some pretty rough draws, if I'm being really honest. Like,
yeah,
like Zandrova first round of US Open, like that's brutal. And then like, because Zandrova barely missed getting, you know. Like, she could have gotten many other better draws.
She got Garcia a few times.
Yeah, Garcia like 3 times in the year.
Yeah.
Each time Garcia played like one of her best matches of the year and like seemed to always peak against her. And then like, there for like the Hadaj Maya winning it over her in San Diego. And like, same thing, she just played like a peak third set. And like, but Dana is like always looking to like keep getting better. And she's like, she really grinded this whole year. Like,
yeah. I think grinding is definitely the better word to describe how her season was, because it wasn't great tennis wise. I think she played good matches here and there, took tough losses, as you mentioned.
There was a time this year where she was like struggling with her ball toss quite a bit.
Yeah, she was. I think she changed her service motion. You should check it out.
New service motion looks a lot more efficient to me, because she's still hitting the wide serves really nicely. She's still getting the nice angles.
Yeah.
It's opening up the court, because that's ultimately what you want. Because she's never going to have the biggest serve. She's 5'4" or 5'3", maybe. I think she's like on the shorter end.
She's on five. She's the same. She's about the same height as Ash Barty. I think she's 5'6".
Oh, okay. Yeah, but just in stature, she's probably not one of the stronger, muscular type girls. Let's just say. So she has to work harder to win points. So for her, like that placement on the serve with the new motion and like it's looking better. Like, I didn't see any issues with her toss.
It was a lot better. She still got broken a couple times, but that's to be expected, to be fair.
I do wish
she would, it's probably a bit of a style of play, but I do like when she takes a step back sometimes, like off of the baseline instead of like taking so many shots off of the half volley. Because especially on the forehand side, is the one that she can get like more loopy and like lands a little short. That Siniakova used that a lot to her favor. But I was really glad to see that Leila just kind of raised her level and started like actually kind of like ripping a little bit more, be more on the attacking side. I thought she used the slice a lot better as well.
A good slice.
Yeah, I think she should use it more often, to be fair. Yeah. But
I like it. I like the way she's able to defend with her passing shots.
Yeah. But that was
She absorbs the pace really well. She's got these, like, because she stands so close to the baseline, she doesn't need to take huge swings.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you're definitely right. Like, sometimes she would be better off being like 4 or 5 feet behind the baseline and just absorbing a little bit more pace and then working her way back up. I think that could help her, especially on clay as well.
Mm, yeah.
But she's done well in the past, and that strategy seemed to work actually in some of those matches.
Yeah.
What else? Oh, yeah. I was going to say that I think the move to play doubles with Taylor Townsend is really paying off.
Maybe, yeah.
Like, in a sense, like, not right now, but I think in the long term it will.
Yeah.
Because, like, Townsend is a good mentor to have for her. It's kind of like an older sister of the tour, and she's, like, really taking Leila under her wing, and they've had some really good doubles results.
Yeah.
Which I thought
it was interesting how... Yes. Yeah. I thought it was so interesting how they played such a high level, like in doubles the whole year, made a couple finals, and then the first title that Leila wins this season is in singles. So like, I think it was kind of
a shame that they weren't rewarded with at least one title in those doubles, because that could have been devastating too. Like, they worked so hard, all of them, to get there, and they just narrowly lost out in some of those matches, but... No, I think it's going to help her like in the long run. And I was reminded she's only 21. She just turned 21.
Yeah, she's just a month older than Raducanu.
Yeah, because she turned 19 during the
US Open. During the US Open,
So she's setting herself up for a good 2024. I think if she can get herself seated for Australia, that's a big win.
Yeah. And just to to go back to your point of a next gen final in the WTA, that would be great because then Layla would qualify, and then we have Mira Andreeva qualifying as well. There's a few others.
Mira Andreeva is 16. My goodness, she's born in 2007.
I think Fruvertova should qualify as well.
Fruvertova, Noshkova, there's still good players who are 21 and under. I think
you would have been a great field. Yeah. You could have been a great joint tournament if the ATP made it with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Something in the future. Yeah. I don't know.
But when they merge, if that ever happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I guess it covers it all. Like, what's next week's tournament? After the US Open, it's always a little bit of a blur for me. It's just kind of not exactly sure what's going on. But we have
we have Tokyo on the ATP side, which is a 500. Then we have Stockholm and Antwerp, which are 250s.
Yeah.
We have Runa's the number one seed, and Tsitsipas the number one seed.
And we have Monastir, where Onda is unfortunately not playing. And another tournament in China, and then China Open. Jiangxi Open, actually. And the Transylvania Open in Romania.
Yes. Cluj, Napoca. Yeah. So I think it's a bit of a lower stakes WTA next week. Since, like, you probably won't see a lot of the top 20 players playing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a few. Like, I think Harad Maya is playing in Romania and stuff, but for the most part, I think because the field is already set in Cancun, it's more of a lighter week for them. Yeah. For men, the big tournament is Tokyo, and we got a couple of top players than the other.
Yeah. Just trying to get the final.
Well, but now we're back on track. Like, no more Wednesday through Tuesday, and no more 2 week master. So we're back on to the regular Monday through Sunday schedule, which is what, like, we're all used to.
Yeah. Which is good. But so great to have finally another talk of tennis. It's the first podcast in a while that I actually record with you, but you have great times as always. Pretty long one. So I guess we covered everything from basically since the US Open up until today. So
I'm actually pretty happy we were able to do that in, you know, an hour and a half, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot we covered.
Yeah. All right. So thank you very much. And thanks for everyone who's listening to that. Thanks for sticking around. Follow us on our social media. We are on Twitter at Tennis and Bagels. We do have an Instagram where sometimes I post, but it's not super often. But if you want to give us a follow there as well, that's something that you can do. And on YouTube, where we post all of these videos as well. You can look at our faces as we do this podcast thing. And
you got some gaming content.
I do got gaming content. I'm not sure if people like this, but I love doing it. I know tennis games. There's a community that likes them. Unfortunately, like most things in tennis, it sucks to make tennis games, and it just kind of got dropped off back in 2014. And there's no major titles, I believe. So that's the sadness of the thing. Like, tennis, another ball dropped in terms of the tennis marketing world, like, that, like, it could bring in new fans, but alas, it is what it is. Thanks so much for listening and for following us everywhere and liking our content. So yeah, thanks so much. Thanks much for the podcast, and see you later. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.